Do you have more pictures of your goats than yourself on your phone? Does your vacation time get spent attending goat shows? Can you have a conversation without bringing up dairy goats? Neither can we. So join us as we talk to the country's best breeders, judges, appraisers, and industry experts about all things dairy goats. We are John Kane and Danielle Caroli. Welcome to Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. What's up, everyone, and welcome to Ringside. I'm John, and as always, I'm joined by the proud owner of King's Rock Obergeddon, Danielle Caroli.
Is that the official name?
I think it is. It's got to be. I think that's it.
That's it? Okay.
Is there a veto? Are we good?
We can go with it. That works. So what is it again?
It is King's Rock Obergeddon. If you want to put, like, if you have, like, letters for the sire or something that you put in your registrations, you can do that. Okay. But instead of Armageddon, it's Obergeddon. Okay. Hopefully she's brown.
She's brownish. We'll make it work. We'll figure it out.
All right. Well, you know, everybody seemed to enjoy that name, which literally on the post, Danielle, I was typing out the names that was said on the episode, and that one came to me, and I threw it out there, and it kind of caught, and I like it. And I know that our guest, Dr. Kurt Schnipke, is upset because he came up with some names as well, and I didn't use it. And I'm sorry, Dr. Schnipke, please forgive me.
That's okay, but Danielle, you can thank John for not using my name. Listenership, if you want to veto, my favorite was King's Rock, comma, or is it Boulder?
Well, that's what, so John sent me that name, and at first I read it and was trying to figure out what it was, and then I realized we were playing on rock in the herd name, and jokingly said that I need to have a King's Rock paper scissors, and if I can fit paper scissors shoot, make that work, but I haven't bothered to count it out. There might be a King's Rock paper scissors coming out sometime, because I just have never kind of used rock as anything before, and it's always just been part of my herd name. And that one opened up my eyes to, like, oh shoot, we could have some fun with this. So there might be a King's Rock paper scissors sometime out there. We'll see.
Well, if you get twins, then it can be, what is it, rock, paper, scissors, and lizard Spock, if you're a Big Bang. That's what I was
thinking. Yeah, exactly. There we go. I like it.
I like that, too. Dang, I might have to change my herd prefix here. Well, Dr. Schnippy, how are you? How's kidding season treating you?
Oh, it's going. You know, this year looks very different than the past, I would say, 15 years. For the past 15 years, I've freshened anywhere between, usually between 16, and the most that we ever freshened was 27. And I promised myself I would never do 27 again. That was awful. To those of you that freshen 27 or more in a day and you say, oh, that's easy. Okay, I get it. I'll give you your participation ribbon for having more births in one day than I have in a year. But for me, 27 was a lot. And even last year, I think I did 22. That was a lot. So cut back the herd quite a bit. And I only bred 9 this year. So as of yesterday, I had another doe freshen. I've got 6 of the 9 are fresh and waiting on 3 more. So it's been a slower pace, but it's been an enjoyable pace this year. And certainly my wallet and time constraints thank me.
Well, and you're having quite the doe year so far, it seems.
Yeah, I guess I haven't even really truly added up the exact numbers, but if I do it quickly in my head, 5, 6, 7 does to 4 bucks.
That's awesome.
Can't complain. And already got one of the buck kids to his new home, and he's going to a well-established Oberhasli herd that has done some really cool things with some bucks from me already. And so that's always good when buyers show up and they're ready and can come get their animals quickly and take some more of the workload and the stress off of us. So
it's really awesome when buyers can come super quick to pick up the kids that they ordered.
I think it was Julie Mathis that said something about buyers with money and transport will have preferential treatment or something to that effect. And I thought, yeah, that is the truth.
You need to have both of those.
So
yeah. Come with money in hand and pick up the kids quick. Like,
yeah, I think it was technically something like those with money and a ride will get first preference or something to that effect. But it was very much true. And I think anybody that saw that was sitting there going, preach right now.
Yeah, I feel that. Danielle, your does have turned on the baby making button and you've had quite a few sets of multiples for once. How's that going for you?
We've doubled the kid crop more or less with two does, which is what happens. Or no, we've added more than double. So we've added more than double with two does, which is what happens when you go from four singles to a set of triplets and a set of twins. I have another doe that I thought was going to give me 21 days, but based on her udder development, I am actually watching her closely. She is a doe that has horrible, horrible heats. I always really struggle to catch them. And so we bred her the one time, which she would be due, or she would have been due the 17th. Looking at her, all of a sudden her udder really came in. I had her due for around the 10th of April. So it's totally possible that what I thought was a heat 21 days later was not a heat, and I just read it wrong, but we'll see. So I'm kind of keeping an eye on her, but very cautiously keeping an eye on her. Hoping she doesn't really go with my track record of carrying babies for longer than wanting to carry babies for longer than 155 days. But at the same time, I think the udder development is saying that that's not the case. We'll see what happens. But obviously, because I'm not sure of her due date now, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to let nature happen and go sorry to the babies, because they were only just starting to get some grain from their mother. And so we'll see kind of how that all plays out. I was very impressed with myself the other day, because I had the triplets born the night before. And that day I had a presentation, not that I was giving, but I was running. I was responsible for the Zoom and the PowerPoint and all of these fun things. So right before that, it was starting at 1, and I knew I had to feed my babies, which my four babies would have been really easy, but these newborn triplets meant bottles, and so I knew I had to give myself a little bit of time. So right before the presentation, I ran home for lunch and gave myself what I thought was about an hour to feed everybody and then come back and get it all set up. And I arrived at my barn. I checked on the doe that just kitted and decided to glance into the pen and see how this first freshener was doing, because I thought she was getting close, but I didn't think she was that close. Well, couldn't find her right away. So just knew that, oh shoot, this is going to be fun. And how are you going to explain to the organization that is putting on a huge presentation and you're running it that I'm sorry, I have a goat giving birth, and so
sorry guys, I can't do this today. We got baby goats.
Right, exactly. Somebody log into my computer, find the presentation, run it, please, and do all of the stuff that I was supposed to do. So I looked in the pen, and sure enough, there was a baby on the ground, and knowing that the clock was ticking, I saw that that baby was stable and went and put on my Carhartts and all of my sweatshirts and things like that, because Didn't have time to change after I took care of the baby, so figured I might as well like put on layers that I could remove. So went, grabbed my stuff, got back to the pen, saw that there were two legs coming out of this doe, and ran into the pen to catch another baby. And so then took care of that baby because that one needed a little more assistance because it was still covered in goop, all this stuff. Somehow, in the hour, I grabbed the one baby, grabbed the other baby. So, like, delivered two kids. So, I'm not going to count it delivered because I really didn't do much besides grab them from the pen. Got them all situated, gave them colostrum, gave the other three a bottle, fed my other four. Thank God they're on the bar, and milked the mother and heat treated the milk and showed up back to work with 3 minutes running, 3 minutes late. So
Not bad.
I have no idea. I was on cloud nine and I just felt like I was a superhero at that time because there, if I mean, if the delivery hadn't gone well, all of these things, it would have taken way too long. It just somehow it worked. And the people in my office think I have my stuff together. So we can
Little
pretend.
do they know.
Little do they know, but yeah, so I was a big pat myself on the back. I don't usually do that, but I was really impressed with how it all came together.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
I have another, like, just as we're recording on the 20th, just shy of 4 weeks before I have to worry about any more kids. I did have something cool that happened in my life that I can't really talk about right now. And I don't even know if anything's going to come of it, but just send some positive vibes my way, folks. And then hopefully in the future here, I can talk about it. Unless you guys have something else to cover, I don't think there's much ad good news. Should we just like jump right into the topic?
I certainly think we can.
In 2022, ad could change the scorecard to split back and rump, and then took the points from stature, added them to back and rump as well. We have throughout the podcast, taking an episode or two to dive into various aspects of the scorecard and figured it was time to discuss the back and the rump in detail. And to do that, who better than Dr. Kurt Schnipke, owner of Overboard Dairy Goats, advanced judge and professor here to educate us all. So, Kurt, let's jump right into it, huh?
Sure.
Usually, we start the episode with asking our guests to introduce themselves and their herds, but I don't think we really need to do that, Kurt, because you've been here quite a bit. You are a staple of Ringside. For those that might not be aware, we have grown in size and scale since our success with TikTok. Daniel, can you, for those that are newer, can you kind of give us like the elevator pitch of who you are and how you earned the doctor in front of your name?
Sure. So, well, I am Dr. Kurt Schnipke. I'm a doctor of physical therapy. So I earned that at my alma mater, the University of Findlay, right here in Northwest Ohio. It was close to home when I was in high school and I had heard great things about their physical therapy program. And ultimately, the passage rate on the National Physical Therapy Examination, smaller class sizes, which is what I was used to. I went to a very small high school, and also in job placement, truly before graduation, meaning when you were out on clinical rotations, a high percentage of students were already getting offers at their clinical rotations to come and work then upon graduation. And so all of those things kind of culminated in me going to the University of Findlay. I obtained my doctorate in physical therapy there. And have been working in the field of physical therapy for about 11 years now. And 5 years ago, I was asked to return to my alma mater as a lab assistant. And then after doing that for 2 years, one of which was right during the height of the pandemic. So that was fun, adjusting to teaching hands-on skills over a computer screen. But then they had an opening for a full-time faculty member. I applied and earned the position. So I have been teaching now full time for just about going on 3 years. And what I find that is interesting is developing a sense of observation of function and form and movement. Once I've been able to train my eye not only to human movement, I've also been able to train it to you know, goat movement is the primary, but you know, you can also start to train it to other species as well. I don't know all of the nuances of, let's say, racehorses, or all of the nuances of dog movement and certain breed differences, of course, but you can certainly start to see different things such as if something is limping, be it a human, be it an animal, you know that something is in pain and it's not working quite right. That's a pretty general, that's an easy one that the lay person can probably see, but it also helps to develop a better sense of, well, why are they doing that? And one of the things that I often try to impress upon my students is not just that we know how to treat it, but why are we choosing that treatment approach compared to something else? And so the same thing with movement or structure of an animal, even if they're not limping in the show ring, which, you know, hopefully they're not, but even if, you know, 25 animals come in the show ring or are coming out for visual inspection by an appraiser, you should be able to determine, well, why is that front end moving that way? Or why is that rump structured that way? Or why does this one hold its head up higher than another? And so being able to look at form and function, like I said, once you train it pretty well in one, you can start to see it in other things. And certainly then, you know, as far as humans, adding a lot of in-depth education and practical field experience has helped with that.
So that actually leads so perfectly into our next question, because honestly, part of the reason we wanted to talk to you was because you have that practical clinical knowledge in humans, and the physical therapy field is so driven by the mobility and making sure that there is functional movement. And I think that applies very much, as you said, to dairy goats as well, not even just in the show ring, but just as they are existing. But before we kind of really dive into the dairy goats, when you're looking at humans, just so we can kind of relate on the person level before we apply it to the dairy goats, when you're looking at humans, what kind of issues do you see if there's a problem in our backs or the quote unquote rump of a human?
Yeah, so it's a multifactorial problem. And so, you know, I'll start by saying one of the things that I often tell my students is don't chase a diagnosis. You know, you might get a diagnosis from a doctor of, let's say, lumbar radiculopathy, which would be like a radicular pain or a nerve pain in the back or caused by something in the back, or you might just get low back pain, or you might get lumbar stenosis. That doesn't necessarily always mean that that's exactly the problem. You know, if you have imaging and an MRI, those are pretty hard to refute, but there are times when I'll get a general diagnosis of low back pain, and in evaluating them, they have low back pain. Yes, that's the symptom. That's not the actual root problem. The problem is maybe they have degenerative osteoarthritis in their hip and they're walking funny, and they're, well, going back to the example of limping, that's causing them to shift weight off of one side and placing more weight and compression onto another, which then starts to create a muscular imbalance, which is then starting to tug at the structures in the back in different ways. So that's just one example where maybe there's not even something necessarily idiopathic, but in the back, but it's referring to back pain. So there's a lot of things that we do in human evaluation and assessment to help evaluate and look at what is actually going on here. So going back to my point, I'll often tell my students, don't rush to find the diagnosis. That will eventually present itself. Find the dysfunction, find the lack of mobility, the lack of ability in that person's daily life. So for example, if they are having difficulty rolling from one side to another in bed, or simply having a difficulty laying on my side hurts, or I can't sit for very long because my back starts to hurt even more, all of those types of things become a dysfunction. And if you look at and treat those eventually the diagnosis will present itself via assessment tools. Now, certainly there are times when it's very easy to find those things as well, but other times it's a little bit more difficult. And the same nuance can be said for animals, and specifically, you know, I'll try to keep it to caprine or goats here. You don't always know exactly what's going on, but you can see the dysfunction, right? How many of us have had those moments where you have an animal that is limping, and our first thing that we sometimes will run to is, okay, well, what's going on with the foot and the hoof? Do they have something stuck in their foot? Is it a stone, or did they step on a nail? And sometimes, you know, you have older barns or things, and or a sharp stone gets in there or whatever. So we check that. Or sometimes in the show arena, the first thing I look at is, were they recently had their hooves trimmed, and maybe they got them trimmed a little too short, and so now they're sore on it. But maybe you don't see any of those things. And so the next thing, you know, logically that you would look at and assess is, in humans, we say look up and down the chain. So up the chain from the hoof would be looking at the pastern, looking at the knee, looking up at the elbow or the hock, depending on whether you're at the foreleg or the rear leg. And then moving your way up and working up that chain. It's sort of like, you know, that song, the ankle bone's connected to the shin bone's connected to the knee bone. It's all one chain. And so if you really look at that and break it down into its individual parts, and then how those parts then work together in harmony, or they should be working in harmony, you can really start to evaluate and assess the situation a little bit better.
So I think sometimes mobility is so vital as a human. But then also, I think it's just the same with dairy goats as well. Like you were just saying, can they get to food? Can they go to water? Can they walk around and maintain muscle condition? How are these two aspects of dairy goats, their back and their rump, geared so that they can function efficiently?
Well, you know, I think it's important to note that there's all sorts of studies. And again, since my background is and professional experiences in humans, you know, it does not take a rocket scientist to figure out, although there are innumerous number of studies that have shown those with a sedentary lifestyle have increased morbidity rates and have different comorbidities that make their lives more challenging, such things like obesity or decreased mobility can lead to depression. It can lead to increased risks of cancer. It can lead to increased risks of feminine hygiene issues and male hygiene issues, incontinence. It can lead to increased stress. So the same thing can be said for animals and livestock. If they are not moving properly, they're going to become more sedentary. And the more sedentary they become, they're not able to fulfill their function, and they're not able to fulfill basically their best life. With a goat, I would argue their best life is being happy and chewing hay and feed and chewing their cud. And if it's a dairy goat, then they are able to hopefully efficiently convert all of that feed and water into a byproduct of milk, right? And it goes without saying, if you're showing dairy goats, we know that, you know, filling the udder is part of the hallmark of showing a goat. It's also part of, even if you're not showing, if you're appraising, typically you want at least some milk in the mammary system when they're being evaluated. And even if you don't do any of the performance programs, if you are having a milk goat for a hobby herd or a backyard farmstead, you want to produce milk from an efficiency standpoint to provide for your family or to provide for creating milk-based products. So again, it goes without saying, if you are incapable of proper movement, it's going to lead to a more sedentary life. A more sedentary life is going to increase higher risks of morbidity or lower lifespan.
That makes a lot of sense. As we mentioned in the intro, it was in 2022 that the scorecard was updated to create two separate categories for back and rump. And we've talked about it before on the podcast, maybe even with you. But what does that look like when looking at a goat and evaluating a goat in that scorecard category and just adding those extra points to and separating back and rump from each other?
Well, I think what it does is, well, first of all, we have to look at where did we get some of the extra points. So removing stature, because quite honestly, I saw it misused way too often. There were way too many instances of stature being used for the tallest goat having the greatest stature. And that's not what stature ever meant. Stature is the upstandingness, or in other words, being somewhat taller at the withers than at the hips. So I like to explain it like they should have sort of a less extreme look as a giraffe. If you look at a giraffe's back, they're definitely taller at their you know, withers than they are in their rear end, or their front end is taller than their rear end. Now, we don't want quite that extreme of a look, but it should be a more natural slope. Somewhere between 10 to 20 degrees is what you can, you know, kind of look at visually in your mind. Now, I don't need everybody to go out with a compass or a protractor. I'm just saying in human anatomy, we have something called a goniometer that helps us read the angle of joint movement. And so even without a goniometer, I can visually look at something and see what the approximate angle is. And so again, I'm not advocating for a specific number here. I'm just saying if you're that type of person that you need a literal number of what should that look like, think approximately 10 to 20 degrees. Where did that upstandingness go? Well, now it's just in the general category of general appearance. So it does say an attractive framework with femininity or masculinity in bucks, strength, upstandingness, length and smoothness of blending throughout that create an impressive style and graceful walk. So the idea of that upstandingness that used to be stature, or how it should have been used, is still there. It's just not its own subcategory now. And so then that freed up points for back and rump. And I'll also segue into one of my personal pet peeves. And I know it's done a lot. I know it's very industry-wide, but very often we'll hear the word top line, and it's referring to the back, or it's referring to the back and the rump specifically, the whole top line. And I do understand it's an industry term, but for me specifically, I like to delineate, you know, where on the top line is it? Is it the chine? Is it the loin? Is it the chine and loin combined, which would encompass the back? Or is it the rump? Because the back and the rump are two different structures. They serve two different purposes. Yes, they tie together in the overall harmony and fluid motion of a goat, but they do have two different functions, and they do have two different effects on the overall ability of the goat.
Ooh, so excuse me while I just go edit some of my Facebook posts I made the last 2 days.
It's just my personal pet peeve, and certainly am I guilty of saying top line from time to time. Sure, it's I always say top line is like the low-hanging fruit of dairy goats. When you see a picture or you see an animal live, what's one of the first things that people recognize is the top line. How board level is it, right? And I'll see it all the time on these really perfectly level goats. Of people will make comments on social media of, look at that top line. And, you know, it's not my position to say, well, it's actually her back, or it's actually this, but it's just a pet peeve. But it is, it's the low hanging fruit. It's the easy thing for the eye to see. Similar to the next easy thing for the eye to see is either a really long forerudder or really weak pasterns in an animal. You can see those very quickly. It's, again, I call those the low hanging fruit. You should be able to see those rather easily. In delineating the back and rump, again, I have been in favor of it, and it allows for really clearly giving some ability to assess those differences in back and rump, because you might have an animal that is very strong in her chine, very strong in her loin, but has a very poor rump structure, or vice versa. You might have one that has a very weak chine and leads to issues in the loin, but when you get to the rump and the pelvic structure, it's actually pretty good. So it does allow for some delineation and nuance when comparing one animal to another, specific to that back and rump. And again, it really kind of ties into, there's two very different functions of those regions of the goat.
All right. So let's kind of dive into them, and we'll split them up first. We'll go on into the back, and then we'll move into the rump. What are some of the things that you see that cause issues in the back with a dairy goat?
So again, it's a multifaceted issue. There's multiple things that could be wrong. First and foremost, I will say an animal that typically is very weak in the chine, or sometimes, you know, we'll call it like a dip in the chine or not level in the chine. Very often there will be a compensation with the loin. And so sometimes we can see that in layman's terms as kind of a sway back, where it kind of looks like a little bit of a wavy appearance to it when you first look at it. There's also other issues. If the goat is very lacking of upstandingness, meaning they're shorter in the front end than they are in the rear leg. Danielle, not to pick on your breed here, but it's one of the things that has been a chronic issue within the Nubian breed for many, many years. They're starting to improve in that area and starting to improve the overall appearance of that. But the Nubian breed for a very long time was known as being a little bit shorter in the front end and being a little taller in the rear end. And what it did is it created some of these top line issues or these back issues. See there, I used my own pet peeve, but again, it is easier to understand when you look at it as mm-hmm. a whole,
yeah.
But it created some weaknesses in the chine. It created some arch or some sway to the loin. And thereby then also that can contribute to a steeper rump angle as well.
And then what about weight distribution? I mean, first of all, I knew the Nubian thing was coming because it is something that they are notorious for. I mean, besides, so often we even hear the term roached, that they're roached in the loin with the Nubians as well. And that kind of comes, in my opinion, from animals that are very short in that chine, and so that loin is trying to compensate for that shortness. But what about weight distribution? If an animal does dip in the chine, is that throwing off the balance of the animal and putting more pressure on maybe the front end or the back end when it should be a little bit more balanced?
Well, it's certainly an imbalance in the spine at some point, and it could be an imbalance happening at the loin, or it could be an imbalance happening at the chine. It could be an imbalance where something is happening in the front end assembly at the shoulders that's then throwing off everything behind it. So it's kind of that, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Sometimes it's something on the rear end of the goat. Sometimes it's something on the front end of the goat. So there's not really one clear cut answer to that problem. So you have to really be able to look at and decipher where is the issue. That way, you know, I can hopefully fix this and move forward with a stronger generation moving forward. So I think anytime you have something that looks less than ideal, there's typically an imbalance somewhere. So again, if you have a weak chine and then that roached or highly arched loin, there's an imbalance within that spine right there. Inherently, there's then also going to be an imbalance in the weight distribution of what that spine is then supporting, which is the, you know, the skin and the fascia and the supportive structures of the barrel and how it supports the organs, right? And so there's inherently going to be some weight distribution that's not correct in that area. Again, is that caused by an issue in the spine, or is it caused by an issue in the front end? Is it caused by an issue in the rear end? It could be any one of those. And so it's a little bit trickier to really dive into and decipher which one is it. And it could be all three.
And when we're looking at the conformation and the back specifically, what's the ideal that you want to see in that back?
Well, again, I tend to revert back to our scorecard for our first and foremost guidance. So, you know, looking at our updated unified scorecard, the back is strong and straight with well-defined vertebrae throughout, taller at the withers than the hips. So there's kind of building in that upstandingness or stature right within the back. And level chine with full crops into a straight, wide loin, wide hips, smoothly set and level with chine and loin. In other words, we don't want that weakness or that dip
in the chine. We don't want that roach in the loin. Sometimes when we look at the loin, if you look at the loin over the top of the animal, it will be unidimensional. And what I mean by that is it's the exact same width at the beginning of the loin than it is at the end of the loin. And so we actually don't want that. We want it to be wide, but you want a slight increase in that width from front to rear. So the most rear portion of the loin should be slightly wider than the most forward position of the loin. And so again, if we're using that pet peeve, that initial look at the top line or the initial look specifically at the back, so everything directly behind the wither or the top of the shoulder blade and to the hip bones, which are the first primary bones that you get to in the rump if you're moving from front to rear, that should be virtually level or with that slight little rise from the hips up to the withers.
I want to talk about the chine and the loin in that back area, because I do feel like there are separate structures in that, but also for all of us, they are very easy to see, right? If people mm-hmm. aren't saying top line, they're saying loin and chine. That dip in the chine, the reaching of the loin, etc. How does that affect the dairy goat movement and functionality?
You know, first of all, it's just aesthetically, you know, whenever we've seen that animal that has that wavy or sway back, just aesthetically, it's not as pleasing as one that's perfectly level. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why, you know, if you take two pictures of two animals, put them on any form of social media platform, and one has a wavy top line or back, and the other one has a straight back, 9 times out of 10, people are going to comment the better doe is the one with the straight back because it's more aesthetically pleasing. It's the low hanging fruit, right?
Right.
So beyond an aesthetics purpose, again, whenever you create an imbalance, it's sort of like if you've ever had a stone in your shoe, but you didn't have time to take it out. And so you walk a little bit more funny because you don't want to put as much pressure on that side. You're going to create an imbalance. Now, usually you're going to be able to take your shoe off within a short amount of time, even if it's, let's say, an hour at the most extreme or 2 hours at the most extreme. But imagine if you had to keep that pebble in your shoe every day, because that was your structure, right? The structure of your back. And then you're walking funny every day or imbalanced every day. Eventually, that's going to lead to some degenerative wear and tear in an area that it otherwise might not if you had that inherent strength. So it's going to lead to faster wear and tear in the joints in front of, aka the front end assembly and the shoulders, or the joints behind, aka the hips or the thoroughs, or down into the legs.
Well, and then it also, I mean, we'll get into the rump shortly, but I'm thinking visually, if that loin area is being kind of higher than the withers, it is popping the rump up in the air as well. And then doesn't that also shape how the udder fits under that dairy goat? And maybe she does have a nice, well-attached udder, but because it's high up, and I'm kind of picturing almost probably something that it's just not pretty in my head anyway, but the placement of that udder is influenced by the chine, the loin, and the rump. And then is it too far back? Is it that, are you able to see that balance of the one third, one third, one third? And does it become more of a multi-category issue in that scorecard, that it's not just general appearance, it's also causing issues with the mammary system as well, or body capacity, or we can even say dairy strength, or however we want to look at it? But can it influence other things as well, not just the structure of that, the back and rump area?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also important to note, like, why are the chine and loin different? So the chine is the area of the chine is sort of like what we would call the thoracic region in a human. And certainly we can sometimes call it thoracic region in a goat as well. But think of that as like
the vertebrae of the spine where your ribs articulate or attach to. So if you weaken the chine or lower it, you're going to inherently, usually, not always, potentially shorten the length of the ribs and shorten the actual capacity or the space of everything that's in the ribs. Well, what is usually protected by the ribs? It's the same in animals as it is in humans. The lungs and the heart, the stomach, the most vital organs for survival, right? So if you compress that amount by having a weaker chine, not only is it going to lead to visual issues and imbalances and wearing out, but it could compress the amount of space for the vital organs. Again, if your heart isn't pumping as efficiently or just isn't getting the same amount of volume, right? The amount of blood that it can pump with each pump, right? We all know that it takes blood to get into the mammary system to help the mammary system convert minerals and feedstuffs and water into milk. It stands to reason if you are compressing and making it harder for the animal to breathe and pump blood efficiently, they're not going to be as efficient in milk production. So for those that like to tout, I want my goats to milk and I want them to milk a lot. That's the function of a dairy goat. And I agree with that. That's one of the functional problems, right? So then the loin is our lumbar region or the lumbar vertebrae. So that's sort of like your lower back. Well, what does your lower back do? It supports all of the structures above it, but it also serves as the base of support for both the pelvis to connect to, the legs then connect to the pelvis, and it connects kind of the common ground between the lower half and the upper half. So it's sort of like connecting the back half and the front half of the goat. So the lumbar area or the loin does a little bit more of supporting things, whereas the chine certainly supports things. But if it's weaker, you're also going to have compression of structures because you're inherently going to affect the ribs as well.
What about, we'll move on a little bit here to the rump structure and how does Sure. that translate to what we see conformation-wise and what the ideal is in the rump?
Well, again, you know, I'll go to our scorecard language. So in the rump, we went strong, uniformly wide and nearly level from hips to pin bones and thorough to thorough. Thoroughs set 2/3 of the distance from the hips to the pin bones.
Ooh, well, can I pause you for a second? Can I pause you? Can you please explain what a thorough is? Because I see so many people confused on what a thorough is.
Yeah, so the thorough is the socket joint where the actual leg bone or the femur connects. If you feel on your own body, what we typically call like the hip bone, the top of that is actually what we call the iliac spine or the iliac crest, right? So that's what you feel kind of at the outside. But where your leg bone actually articulates and connects to your pelvis, in humans we call it the acetabulum. It's a ball and socket. The femur or the leg bone has the ball, and then the acetabulum in the pelvis is the socket, right? Mm-hmm. So the thorough is where the articulation of the goat's leg bone or femur actually joins into the junction of the pelvis. So that's why the thoroughs are important.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thoroughs are set 2/3 of the distance from hips to pin bones, well-defined and wide pin bones set slightly lower than the hips, tail head slightly above and smoothly set between pin bones, tail symmetrical to body and free from coarseness, vulva normal in size and shape in females, normal sheath and testes in males. So we do get some of the reproductive organs are kind of included in rump, and that has always been the case when it used to be just back. So that is kind of in there as well. But again, it really defines everything now from the hip bones back to the tail. And then, like I said, also including some of the reproductive components.
So let's kind of focus, because we are all in the middle of kidding season, that rump structure and the functionality, how does that influence kidding or prevent, or I guess you could even say on the right, or I guess it would be the right, wrong, go cause kidding issues. What structures in the rump kind of influence the functionality of a successful parturition in a dairy goat?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is certainly very applicable right now as most of the country that raises dairy goats and other livestock are going through, you know, birthing season. But it stands to reason, if you've ever had to, as I like to call it, go fishing inside of a dough to help out with either an issue of a poorly presented kid, or the, you know, the dreaded head down or head back position, which I think if you've not gone through that, eventually you will, if you're in goats long enough, and it's the thing that nightmares are made of, as far as birthing complications. But, you know, if you've ever had to go inside of a doe and, you know, elbow deep or further, you appreciate that there are differences in the rump and specifically the pelvis. So, you know, when talking about the rump, it's sort of like the outer buttocks, right? There's certainly muscles to the buttock of a human, but the rump, I kind of think of the rump as like the outward appearance. The inside, or the bones themselves and how they're shaped and structured, is the pelvis itself. And any women out there that have given birth, certainly I'm assuming I've not given birth and I won't, but appreciate having a wider pelvic, what we call the pelvic inlet, which is basically the inner circle of the pelvis, aka the amount of space for the baby to actually pass through with parturition or with birth. Again, there's a reason that certain structures in the rump and pelvis are important specifically to birth, because again, if you can't get the babies out, you either have to go in and surgically intervene via a cesarean section, which that's not always the best approach from not only a cost perspective, but not every animal that has a cesarean section ever comes back from that, right? Or it can lead to future scarring issues or kidding issues later, you know, even if they do live. And again, we have some very talented veterinarians out there. Even the most talented veterinarian has lost some after performing a cesarean section. So, you know, things happen with that. And you certainly don't want to go through that if you can avoid it. That's why we want levelness from thorough to thorough, and levelness from you know, hip to hip, which usually is pretty level. But sometimes I'll see animals that have like a, what we call like a higher dorsal or an A-framed rump. When you look at that rump from the rear, you can see almost this teepee-like, or this outward shape that's taller in the middle of the rump or the dorsal process than it is at the outside edges or the thoroughs. So what that effectively does is it not only increases the amount of pressure on the junction where the ball and socket of the femur and the pelvis actually join. So there's greater pressure, which is going to lead to faster amounts of arthritic changes eventually. So just like humans have arthritic changes over time in our knees and our hips, sometimes our ankles, sometimes our shoulders, but a lot of times the weight-bearing joints of, you know, ankle, knees, and hips, so too happens with goats. And so again, the placement of the thorals not only has a function standpoint in the amount of pressure that it can create in the ball and socket and therefore the wear and tear, but also in the shape of the inner portion, that pelvic inlet. So when you have lower set thoroughs, it actually tightens up the pelvic inlet, thereby giving you less room to work inside that dough if you need to go in. And even if you don't need to go in, if the baby's coming out, we've also had those cases where it's just a huge single kid, right? So sometimes you even have those very large framed or appropriately rumped animals, and the kid is still huge. And you know, you certainly want the widest pelvic inlet that you can get to help get those massive kids out, or those poorly presented kids, even if it's not a massive kid. For example, just the other day, I was very thankful that I had a first freshener with a very nice wide rump. I had to go inside because she had a kid that was stuck. It was just the head coming. I didn't have a front leg. And while yes, you technically can pull kids that way, it's not necessarily appreciated by the doe, and it's a little bit more problematic as far as the spacing, because it changes the angle of the kid when you of their shoulder and creates a wider junction for them when they're trying to get out. So I had to go down and go fishing and find a leg. I could only ever get the one leg. I couldn't get the baby to cooperate and get the second leg up. So I decided to pull at that point with a head and one leg, and everything was fine. Mom and baby are both doing great. But again, my point being, I was happy to have the wider pelvic inlet to give me room to work and get inside and do it safely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely appreciate those doughs that are super wide and able to let you manipulate inside them.
Yeah, I think I'll also comment here. You know, sometimes people say, I want that goat as level as a 2x4 or perfectly board level. And unless the doe is truly upstanding and has that natural slope and that natural angle, I don't actually want my doughs perfectly level or perfectly horizontal
perpendicular to the ground. And the reason for that is after kidding, even after they pass their you know, placenta and the immediate afterbirth, those does, if you really take notice of them, they continue to drain and clean out some of the remnants of pregnancy for a few days, sometimes up to a week. And so if they don't have the natural upstandingness, then they need to have at least a little bit of a natural slope to their rump. Again, I have found approximately 10 to 15 degrees is an appropriate angle there, where it still gives the natural appearance of being very level, just not that perfectly board level, straight across, perfectly, you know, horizontal to the ground appearance.
Well, and the ones that are genuinely like super horizontal, no angulation or very slight angulation, those are the ones that if they have a really tough kidding, tend to have a higher dorsal process for the rest of their life because it just breaks. So, yeah, I agree with that. Let's talk about, I'm going to go back to the thurls because we mentioned what they are, but if they're not placed correctly, what are the potential issues you could see in your goat?
Well, I guess it's easier to kind of relate it back to some human components really quickly. So we do see issues with the ball and socket in humans. And so we call it femoral antiversion or femoral retroversion that can happen. There's also issues with the actual acetabulum, which is, again, kind of the cup or the socket. But specifically to femoral antiversion or retroversion, I won't go into an entire human anatomy lesson here. I know that's not what this podcast is exactly for. But basically, in a nutshell, with femoral antiversion or retroversion, or the placement or the angle at the thurl, what it will lead to is, in layman's term, either duck-footed or pigeon-toed in humans. And so I think we've all seen those people that either toe inward pretty excessively or naturally toe outward, and that's just how they walk, right? So it changes the actual manner in which they biomechanically function or they biomechanically move. There's also ways of looking at that if they have a different wear pattern because they turn their toes in when they walk or they turn their toes out when they walk, it stands to reason that they also can develop muscular imbalances and or arthritic changes earlier in life compared to their counterparts with a more normal or neutral set acetabular or femoroacetabular angle. So the same thing with the thurls. If they're set too far forward or too close to the hips, it's going to create a different pressure point and therefore a different amount of articular wear and tear or arthritis within the joint itself. If it's set too far backward, same thing. So that's where kind of that two-thirds distance between the pin bones and the two-thirds distance from the hips to the pin bones is approximately where you want them placed. And that gives the most optimal usage of the ball and socket of the actual rear leg of the goat. And if you've never seen this in goats, again, sometimes it can take a little bit of time, but you know, if you've ever seen a goat 10, 11, 12 or older, typically they're moving a little bit more sore. And sometimes you can even hear what we call that crepitus or that snap, crackle, pop. And you can certainly hear that in humans as well. I've heard multiple patients that have the snap, crackle, pop, and it is loud and audible and, you know, otherwise known as like the bone on bone grinding that happens when you walk. It really does. It wears out the articular cartilage or kind of like the shock absorption between the bones to the point that then it's very painful to move. Again, if it's painful to move, you don't want to move as often. If you don't want to move as often, it's going to lead to more sedentation or sedentary life. More sedentary life is going to start increasing risk factors for a earlier exit of life.
That makes so much sense. And I want to kind of transition into how the rump structure affects the mammary system really quick. I mean, so often we hear the analogy of you're not going to park a Mack truck in a tiny garage, or, you know, you're not going to need a giant garage for a tiny smart car even. But it's all playing into what we're seeing in that rump and how that's affecting the mammary system. And so can you talk on that a little bit, if you don't mind?
Yeah, and I like those analogies, Danielle. The other analogy that I often like to use is you're not going to fit a square peg in a round hole. You're not going to fit a high and wide rear udder in a narrow and pinched rump and pelvic structure. Usually, there are always exceptions to the rule, and there's always exceptions to the rule in humans, in livestock. We're not talking about those. Those are one-offs. Those are flukes. Those are less common in the overall bell-shaped curve of how animal structure or human structure happens. So we're talking about the majority here. So usually, if you want if you want a rear udder that is 8 inches wide, you're not going to get that with a 5-inch wide rump and pelvis. It's just physically impossible. Unless you overfill the udder and now she's having to swing her legs very uncomfortably around it, which is now lacking any normality to the movement or lacking normal movement, right? So it can be done by overfilling the udder, but it's not aesthetically pleasing. It's not safe to the animal. And usually you still can't achieve the actual goal. You know, another thing to look at is a lot of times people are obsessive about having a rear udder that is so high that it's just below the vulva by, you know, a centimeter or less below the vulva. And certain animals certainly can accommodate that if they have wide enough rump and pelvic structure and the thorough placement is wide enough. They certainly can accommodate that while also having a wide and productive rear udder. But you have to first have the basic width of the rump and pelvis, which is supporting the ligaments of the mammary system, in particular, the medial suspensory ligament, which does the vast amount of supporting the weight and support of the mammary system. Certainly, there's some of the lateral attachments that work down into the leg, and the forward attachment help to support as well. But the primary support of the mammary system is that medial suspensory ligament, and its junction is in with the pelvis. So again, if you want a wider rear udder, sometimes you need to sacrifice inherently some of that height, because you just can't shove all of that width up there if you don't have the base width in the actual rump and pelvic structure. So for me personally, with Oberhasli, it's a more moderate or medium-sized breed. I look for a 7.5, 8, 8.5 inch wide rump if I can. I don't always achieve it, but that's kind of my benchmark that I'm working toward right now, so that I can continue to have wider rear udders and hopefully also work on the height. But while I don't want a rear udder, and let's not conflate the issue here, you know, if the udders on my goats aren't a centimeter below the vulva, I don't get freaked out about it, because I would rather have the width and the total capacity and the uniform width from the top of the udder to the floor of the udder. Some of these udders that are, you know, a centimeter below the vulva, yeah, they're really high, but there's not as much width at the top there. They're kind of the A-framed, or sometimes I call them like teepee-shaped rear udders, where all of the width is at the bottom. There's not really as much milk in that mammary system as one that's maybe an inch below or an inch and a half below the vulva, but it's got uniform width of, you know, 6 or 7 inches of width across the udder from the top to the bottom. I mean, if you really look at those, which one truly has more milk, not accounting for anything like those meaty udders or the ones that don't milk as much. Again, I know there's exceptions to the rule, but if you take two equally productive does, one with a high but A-framed udder, one with a slightly lower but more uniform width of udder, the more uniform udder is going to have more milk every time.
Boy, I was going through a lot of deja vu during that conversation, Kurt.
It's almost like I had that conversation with you once before.
And not too long ago. Well, let's take all of this information and apply it to the practical. That's what you're good at, Dr. Schnipke. Sure. When you're looking at your goats, or maybe even seeing goats in the ring or in another person's herd, what are some things that you can pick up on easily that say potentially this animal is going to break down or have issues because of the back or rump, you know, like the red flags?
Well, I like to use the term that my friend Julie uses, is the rear end assembly, because it's not just the rump. You know, you have to look at the way that the rear legs, the angle and the usage of the stifle joint, which is kind of the connection between the femur, the patella, and the knee,
So it's kind of in that middle joint. It's that middle range, sort of like our knee joint, not the kneecap, but the knee joint. And so you have to look at that. You have to look at the angle of the hocks, the width between the hocks, but also you don't want them over-angulated. And sometimes here's one of the problems that I see specific to Danielle. You know, we mentioned the Nubian breed. And again, Nubian breeders, don't come at me with the pitchforks and the torches. I get it. Every breed has its own problem. For years, Oberhausli were known as having trash udders, so I get it. You can pick on Oberhausli udders all you want, although we have been working to fix those.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes, the problem is either not enough angulation in the rear leg or too much excessive angulation. So sometimes you'll see, you know, these either kids or yearlings posted for sale, and there's not even udder, but you can already see that there's the legs are too long for the goat, and they're exerting enough creative posing of that animal for a photo that they can make the back or the quote unquote top line look really good. But if you look at the rear legs, there's too much angle, there's too much length. And what you'll see is the placement of the hock to pastern is actually sitting an inch or two or more behind the level of the pin bones. That's not a balanced rear end assembly. That's going to eventually cause either issues at the hocks, issues at the stifle, and either of those is going to work its way up the chain, just like it will in a human, into the pelvis, either in creating a different rump angle or a steeper rump, or a higher rump than it is at the hips or at the withers, excuse me, such as what we see sometimes in the more historic cases of the Nubian breed. And so for me, I look at all of those things at once when I'm evaluating, whether it's in the show ring as a judge, in my own herd as a breeder, or if I'm consulted, you know, asked to look at another breeder's program or what they're doing. So I want a rear leg that is appropriately angulated. But when I also look at the way that those legs are placed underneath the animal, I want appropriate width between the hocks without being excessive. Because again, we can go to the extreme on the far end as well. By being too wide between the hocks, that's now causing an awkward carriage to the rear legs or usage of the rear legs. So I want the rear legs to walk approximately 1 to 2 inches wider than the front end. And I want, when you look at the rear legs from behind, it should be perpendicular from hock to pastern without pointing in at each other, or some people will call that like cow-hocked or sickle-hocked. We use some of those terms interchangeably. They are two different things. But I want that to be perpendicular, and then I want it to be perpendicular from the side. And specifically, when you look at where the pin bone ends naturally, directly underneath the pin bone or just slightly behind the pin bone should be where the angle from hock to pastern rests. With that and an appropriate angle when they're young, usually they're going to maintain that throughout their lifetime. And then obviously looking at the structure of the rump and pelvis, I want, again, a long rump, a wide rump, both from hip to pin and from thorough to thorough, and that appropriate thorough placement where it's all level and flat. So flatness of rump and levelness of rump, again, are two different things. And so you just have to be sure what you're actually referencing. But I want it level from hips to pins with a slight angle, again, 10 to 15 degrees naturally, and then level from thorough to thorough without any prominence of the dorsal process or with minimal prominence, understanding that there might be a slight little prominence due to it's some of the terminal end of the spinal column and the vertebrae. It's sort of like the tailbone in a human. That's the dorsal process.
Right. What a great episode, man. I tell you, I'm sorry I had to do all the heavy lifting here, guys. But this is amazing. And I'm sure everybody's like, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to listen to this 18 times and I'm going to be right there with everybody else. This has been wonderful.
It's really a lot to process. And that's why I said in the beginning, it's multifactorial and multifaceted. There's multiple components that play into the joints and the structure of the rump. It's not just the rump. You know, the way that the rump is structured at birth is one thing, but then how the rear legs articulate with the rump, how the back articulates with the rump, how the front end assembly articulates with the back, and then how that therefore articulates with the rear end. I mean, again, it really is back to kind of that song.
the thigh bone's connected to the hip bone, the hip bone's connected to the spine bone, you know, however you want to sing that song. It's all interconnected. It's all one chain, and it needs to be moving as harmoniously and efficiently as possible. You know, when you really step back and train yourself to look for those things, it starts to become a little bit more apparent. And again, I'll say this all the time. My two passions in life are physical therapy and functional sound, livestock, particularly dairy goats. But developing my eyes and developing my hands to feel for things that maybe aren't first apparent to the naked eye, they're my two most valuable tools. I tell my students that all the time. Your two most valuable tools as a physical therapist are first and foremost your eyes, so you can see and observe things, and then your hands, so you can, you know, manually feel and see how they're articulating and moving together. And same thing with animals. The first thing that I rely on are my eyes. And then if it's not first and foremost very apparent to the naked eye, then I'll get my hands on and feel and see how it's feeling underneath the feel test, so to speak.
It's just so interesting because as we're kind of wrapping up, I know we've mentioned the scorecard and we talked on two subcategories of general appearance. And in total, for a senior doe, the back is worth 5 points and the rump is worth 5 points. And this is not saying the scorecard is not weighted properly or anything like that, but I'm just kind of, in terms of the scorecard, it's only 5 points each, but there is so much that there's so much that goes into those quote unquote 5 point categories. And it's the same with all the other subcategories on the scorecard as well, that when you look at them individually, there's so much that goes on, but then you need them all to work well, to really have that strong dairy goat that can function efficiently over a long productive lifetime.
Well, you know, I liken it to the argument, and in the past, this is going to be slightly controversial, but I'm going to go there. In the past, I have been accused of being the breed standard police in my breed, or the color police, as it were. And some people say you don't milk the head, or you don't milk the breed standard, you don't milk the color. That's true. And if that is your, you know, if that is your soapbox, go ahead and stand on it all day. Good for you. I'll give you the breed standards participation ribbon, if you will. But for being 5 points for head and breed characteristics, Danielle, you primarily have Nubians. If somebody told you that they wanted to sell you a Nubian and it had upright, erect ears, are you going to buy it?
No, I would run the other way.
Exactly. Or if somebody had a La Mancha that had 3-inch pendulous ears that go 2 inches past its nose and say, this is 100% La Mancha with a Roman nose, are they going to buy it? Probably not. There's a reason that breeds look a certain way, and it's to delineate them. If we didn't have the breeds, then we could just have one show where all of the 2-year-olds of all breeds just come out all at once, and we have one show, one breed, just all goats come out, sort of like some of the county fairs that I've seen, where all dairy goats 1 and under, all dairy goats 2 and under, all dairy goats 3 and under, and we'd have one champion at the end of the day. There's different nuances besides personality and temperament, but you know, there's a reason that certain people like the Oberhasli for their color or their temperament or their head or their ear shape. There's a certain reason that some people like Nubians for their head and nose shape or their dual purpose, or they like the higher butter fat. There's a reason that people like Nigerian dwarfs for their distinct characteristics. So again, the same could be said about, that's only a 5-point category, but without those 5 points, what makes a Nubian a Nubian?
Exactly. Her vocal prowess.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I don't know. Nigerians are just as vocal as Nubians. I always like to say they have a difference in the way that they're loud. Nubians, I like to think, are like a loud, almost a whiny type of a call to them, where Nigerians tend to have a more shrill, like a shriek to them. When I hear the loud ones. And again, not all of them are. Again, don't get the pitchforks and the torches out, folks. But if you have those breeds, you know it's true. You know those are the loudest two breeds.
I'm going to say My Nubians demand, I think, is probably the best way to describe their vocalizations, is that there's a lot of demand there in that, where I feel that Nigerians are very much a like, what's going on? What's happening? We're chitting, we're chitter chattering and calling out and trying to figure it out. But when at least, I mean, 90% of the time my girls are quiet, but when they talk, they talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Well, this has been a wonderful episode. Dr. Kurt Schnipke, thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's a busy time of year for us all, and we really appreciate you spending the last hour with us. If people wanted to find you on the old interwebs in your farm, where can they go?
Well, the best is on our social media platform. On Facebook, it's Overboard Dairy Goats. I do have a website. It's been out of date due to some web hosting and web server issues, and having to basically rebuild the entire thing. And with teaching obligations, I just haven't found the time to completely revamp that, though it is in process. But if you would like to look at that, it's www.overboard.com.
Danielle Caroli, awesome co-host. If people wanted to find us on the old interweb, where can they do that?
You can find us at DairyGoatPodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook by searching Ringside and American Dairy Goat Podcast. We are on Instagram at Ringside Podcast. And you can find us on TikTok searching us at Ringside Podcast. You can also listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating or review. It really helps us and we appreciate it.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, everybody, this has been Ringside, an American Dairy Goat Podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Danielle.
And I don't know what you're doing, but you need to stop, rewind this episode, and re-listen to it. We'll catch you on the next one.
Ringside, an American Dairy Goat Podcast, is not an affiliate of the American Dairy Goat Association. All opinions or information regarding the ADGA does not represent the registry.